Let's move into finalizations. First finalization will be archery deer hunting season.
Morning, members of the commission and Secretary Hepler. Keith Fisk here with the Wildlife Division. Tom Kirschman's absent today, so he asked me to cover the next two finalizations on his behalf. If you'll please turn your attention to page number 15 in your booklets, we'll walk you folks through the finalization in regards to the archery hunting seasons. Just a little bit of background for Commissioner Locken and others to refresh your memories. Several years ago, you, the commission, did receive a petition to move the archery start date 2 weeks earlier. At that time, the commission denied the petition with the thought that we were going to be moving through the deer management plan process. We completed that this past summer, and since that time, we have had several other people have brought that topic back up to GFMP officials, and you'll see you folks took action at your last meeting and proposed to change the start of the archery season from the fourth Saturday of September and move it earlier there to September 1. Again, just to remind folks, this isn't a biological issue, it's a social consideration. A lot of public comments on this topic, and if the commission did move forward with moving that date earlier, it would indeed provide some additional opportunity for those folks to archery hunt earlier in the season. And you'll see the department recommendation there is we don't propose any changes from what you have proposed earlier there with the start date of September 1. And there's also a table in your booklet there of the surrounding states and what those start dates look like, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you folks may have.
Commissioner Boyd here. One quick question. How does the September start date line up with dates for elk hunting season? Is there overlap? Could you address that, please?
Commissioner Boyd, so the dates for the archery season in the Black Hills start September 1 and it goes through the end of September. So there would be some overlap there in the Black Hills. And I guess I should also add there are several elk hunting units on the prairie, not archery elk hunting, but firearms units down in Bennett County. That season actually starts July 15th, and there's different seasons throughout the summer, so there would be some minor overlap there as well.
Commissioner Peterson.
Okay, this morning a comment was made to enhance recreational opportunities. I think the firearms people are always aware of when we have to bring back lesser tags to keep, you know, because our numbers are down and we're trying to grow our herd, and they are okay with that. We don't get any pushback. But I think we're taking the opportunity for them is not as good as the opportunity by adding an additional month on for the archery. Archery is able to the pressure that can be put on the deer that can hurt the firearm season, and that's my concern. And then, you know, the mule deer population, they're trying to grow that. We're trying to grow whitetail. And in our area, the numbers are low, so we're having less tags, and they have a certain amount of time. And now we're talking about expanding the archery season when we're not expanding other things. And I think we have to find a balance for enhancing for both firearms and archery, because I like both. You know, I want to give those opportunities to both. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Commissioner Peterson, maybe just to help clarify a little bit, it's our thoughts that if the date did move earlier, we wouldn't see a significant increase in harvest. Again, we're not concerned about biologically harvesting more deer that would take opportunity away from folks during the firearm season. We would anticipate that the harvest would stay relatively the same.
Okay. One
comment. Go ahead.
The bucks that much sooner. The archery has improved so much that it's quite a bit easier now to get your deer, which is awesome. And archery hunters are very good hunters. The bucks that get taken out that don't allow for the herds to continue to grow to make it a better experience for everybody. That's one of my concerns too. Even though biologically there won't be more shot, though we've seen in some of the comments that more people do want to come with that idea in mind. So it looks like there could be more shot. So, but thank you.
Okay, go ahead, Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Sharp here. I guess a couple questions that has been presented to me. People worry about harvesting velvet antlers, that type of stuff. There was even a suggestion that maybe what we do is we move in-state up to September 1st and leave out-of-state the fourth Saturday. Couple questions. What would it do kind of for us or to us if we, or what do you think the practical effect would be if we would say the moving it up to September 1st on the bucks, it'd have to be a 4-point or larger? Or what are the practical effects if we would leave out of state the last Saturday towards the end of September and leave in state, move it up to the first? I mean, just what are your thoughts on that?
Commissioner Sharp, and you'll have to help remind me, there are several questions there. So the first one, as far as an antler point restriction, you know, across the United States, there's been quite a bit of research done, and it really has shown that instituting an antler point restriction doesn't really have an impact on the age structure of those deer. In regards to your second question about potentially separating out an earlier date for residents and a later one for non-residents, of course, you, the commission, has the ability to do that if you so chose. Based off of the public comments and talking to some of our staff, I think there is some concern that there might be, some typical non-resident confrontations that we have with all the species, whether it's non-resident waterfowl. We've heard it on these other topics. It's an ongoing issue with everything. So that's still going to be there regardless. If people have access earlier, they're still going to have a potential conflict when their non-residents do show up on the fourth Saturday. So I think you're always going to have that type of a conflict.
Okay, Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Olson, I'm going to ask the commission to support this, and there's many different reasons, but it doesn't matter. It seems like whoever's sitting on behalf of the staff talks about, expanding opportunities for sportsmen, and we put it in our strategic plan. It's a pillar of the entire organization to expand opportunities, and here we are again with another opportunity to expand an opportunity for a group of hunters to get engaged. Yesterday we talked about recruitment, retention, and reactivation of hunters. And I'll tell you, since my son, who's now 8, has been old enough to walk, I've had him out checking trail cameras, and checking, making sure the tree stands are right. And, he, of course, wants to climb up in the tree stands, which Mama doesn't like very much yet. But, that's all in July and August, and we're out really getting active watching the bucks that I want to harvest, And, again, you've heard me say this before, I'm not a meat hunter. I look for one deer a year and very specific about which one it is, and if I don't get it, I don't fill my tag. But, to take that August opportunity to be able to be a field with my son and have him scouting with me when he gets old enough to bow hunt, and to maybe get this September start date where I can get him to sit in a stand or in a blind and enjoy and engage in the outdoors before football starts and all that other stuff that happens after Labor Day is one of the selfish reasons that I want to do this. But I've talked to a couple of other sportsmen. You talked about reactivation of hunters, and I know a lot of older bow hunters, and not even when I'm saying that, not years on the planet, but people that have hunted for a long time, and they got out of it because, it just seemed like the competition and the rifle and everybody locks their land down and things like that, they were just tired of putting up with the cold and the cold feet that you've heard me complain about in the past, and this is something that's engaging to them, that they could get out, and if they got to put on a little mosquito spray or tick spray and be able to enjoy it while the weather's still right, it's another way I think that we get back some of those hunters that maybe have stepped aside. And so between getting new hunters engaged and involved and reactivating them, I mean, it hits on everything that we're talking about as a commission and what we say, and I hope you'll support living up to what we've been talking about in our long-term planning goals. Thank you.
Anything else? Is there a motion? Okay, moved by Russ. Is there
second?
A second? Seconded by Doug. Any other comments, questions? All in favor of the motion would say aye.
Aye.
And opposed?
Aye.
Roll call.
Boyd? No. Lockett?
Aye.
Gary Jensen?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Peterson?
No.
Sharp?
Aye.
Barry Jensen?
Aye.
That's two.
Okay. Thank you.
Next finalization, number 16 in your packet, application for license. If you'll recall, the intentions of this finalization, this last legislative session, there was legislation successfully passed, Senate Bill 137, which removed the minimum date for mentor hunting. So currently, it's 10 years and older, and with the passage of that legislation, it removed that minimum age requirement. And the finalization here that we have before you today is just to bring administrative rule in line with that legislation. And as you can see there, we do not have any recommended changes from proposal and would ask for your favorable approval.
So moved. We need to discuss first.
No, you can make motion.
Second.
Okay, now we can have discussion. Any comments on this one? Yes, go ahead, Doug.
Commissioner Sharp here. In reading this, I'm not sure what a guardian what a guardian would qualify as, but I think it was mentioned in public comments that an older brother may not be able to take a younger brother out and do this mentored hunt. Is that would that be an accurate way to describe this, or would that be would that fall under this mentored hunt opportunity? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I'd ask either Director Life or Andy Albin.
Tony Life, Director of the Wildlife Division here. Commissioner Sharp, the provisions of the mentored hunting program are contained in statute. I believe it's 41681. So that's where the restrictions are in place that we talked some about yesterday. What I believe the point that the gentleman made when he was talking about this is the inability of somebody other than the parent to purchase the license. Because right now statute says only the parent or guardian of the mentor can purchase the license. They then can give written permission to someone else, another responsible adult, to serve as a mentee for that mentor. But right now law says that only the parent or guardian can purchase the license to be used by the mentor.
You follow up?
And I should, Commissioner Sharpier, I should clarify my comments. That could have been an older sister taking out a younger sister to do that same hunt. So I wanted to make sure my comments were very clear. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Other comments? I'm not sure, you know, we're headed in the right direction, taking all these age restrictions off and going younger and younger. But and I also realize we don't have much effect on this proposal or finalization right here, but that being said, any other comments? Okay, the motion has been made and seconded. All in favor of that motion would say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? It is approved.
Thank you.
Hunting party size, Andy.
Good morning. Andy Albin, Law Enforcement Administrator for the Wildlife Division. I'd ask you to focus your attention to page number 17 there with the hunting party size. Last month, you approved the department recommendation to repeal this hunting party size, which is currently set at 20 persons who are in the field possessing essentially a weapon, with an exception right now for predator varmint hunters. This particular item came forward as one of the last remaining items as part of our department rules review process, where we collaborated with folks from across the agency and attempted to take a look at reducing some of that regulatory burden in some cases, impediments to recreation and opportunity out there, and then just looking at some regulations that maybe no longer are needed or have outlived their intended purpose, and this one probably falls within the last category there. Obviously, what we're talking about here, it was enacted primarily as a safety guideline, but I think you can all concur that 20 is a rather arbitrary number. The particular hunting situation, maybe it's the landscape, maybe it's the individuals, the age that's involved of the individuals. Those are all factors that should come into play here with the determination of whether a situation is safe or not. So we're asking you to repeal this and allow those individual hunting groups or maybe a landowner to make those decisions. And obviously a member of the hunting party is going to sign on or not as well to where they think a situation is safe or not. So it essentially puts the decision up to the individual hunter there. As I said before, some of these situations you might have less than 10 people involved, and it may be an unsafe situation depending on the circumstances. One other aspect that I bring to you for consideration too on this issue is from an enforcement standpoint. It's rather difficult sometimes in the field trying to determine one, how many people are out there with weapons when you given the terrain in some of these situations. Obviously our officers know how to count to 20, but sometimes 1 second somebody's on the crest of a hill, then they're below the hill, so it becomes rather difficult in counting guns. Other times we have parties that have a tendency to split up, so you may have one party that's has some folks in it that are working one direction, maybe on the same property, and another group that's working the same direction. To me, those are probably two different groups, so it becomes a little bit convoluted as well. And then when you do have a situation where let's say you have 21 people out there, it can be a little bit difficult and touchy who is in violation. Are they all in violation? Who is the responsible party there? So just some things to consider that I bring to your attention in that regard. It's a little bit more complex issue than meets the eye there, but I'd stand by for any questions. Ask for your repeal of this rule.
Any questions? Commissioner Peterson.
So if I understand right, you would just assume that the groups decide instead of having a number limit. You, law enforcement, it would work easier for them.
Mr. Chairman, yes, okay. Commissioner Peterson, to answer your question briefly, that would be our recommendation.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Sharp.
Commissioner Sharp here. I'll be honest, in looking at this, I was a little reluctant to support it because I have hunted in groups where 20 is a lot. It's hard to manage, but based on your presentation, you do bring up a lot of good points on how you can count, or you know, who do you charge, that kind of thing, and there have been groups of 10 that are terribly unsafe as well. So I would not have any problem supporting this. I guess I would ask, if possible, if sometime down the road, I think a year might be an arbitrary time frame, but if there would be a way for us to keep track of any instances in the field that are related to group size, I think that'd be good information to bring back and see what us changing this has done both for us and to us. So, thank you.
Okay.
Commissioner Sharp, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, comment?
We annually do that hunting accident report, and that will certainly be looked at over the course of the next year or two, and we'll make a point to that our Hunt Safe staff look at that.
Any others? I kind of wanted to set it at 12 with two dogs and four kids, but so. Is there a motion, please? And a second? Okay, Russ. All right, any other comments? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Thank you. And opposed? Okay, moving on. Archery restrictions.
Mr. Chairman, number 18 there in your booklet. We took action last month in Custer State Park to bring forward for consideration two issues that pertain to accompaniment or what you can possess in the field for archery season, archery-only licenses. The first of which, our current rule prevents a hunter who has an archery-only tag from carrying a firearm in the field with them, with the exception of somebody that's got a concealed weapons permit and they have their permitted pistol with them. But if you, right now, let's say a hunter in Brown County has a East River archery license as well as a East River deer tag, that individual cannot go out in the field with both weapons and essentially use that archery tag because of this regulation. So it primarily is an impediment currently to somebody that would otherwise be legal, could do both things, provided they're within those time frames, season dates there. So what this would do essentially would allow that person to have a firearm in the field with them, provided that they have a license that's valid for that same area and the time of year. So we're getting into geography and licensure there. So do have one change from proposal. Gonna ask that you repeal the second provision that we brought forward last month, and that was to allow for an armed non-licensee to accompany an archery big game hunter. So what this issue was aimed at allowing a mixed group, if you would. So if somebody in that same situation that had an archery big game license, somebody that also had a firearms big game license that's valid for that same area and time of year, they'd be able to hunt together, essentially. And we still want that to happen, but a more comprehensive review of some of our other regulations out there, and I've got it down in the supportive information section, we really already have that in another rule that pertains to all hunting in general. So by repealing this second portion or not taking action on the second portion, you're still accomplishing what we set out to do in the initial proposal. It would allow for, that mixing of hunters there, provided they have the same license as valid at the same area and time of year there. So I guess I would ask for your motion to amend first on this issue, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we need to amend it to take out that second portion then, and before we move on the proposal. Russ, is that a motion to amend? Is there a second? And seconded by Kathy. Any other questions about that? All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? It is amended. And so then that would bring us to the proposal as amended. Is there a motion on that? Mary Ann, and a second?
Second.
Seconded by Doug. Any questions? All in favor of the amended proposal would say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? It's approved. Thank you. Fur dealers.
Yes, the next item in your booklet, number 19, pertaining to fur dealers and like bait dealers, our officers and staff routinely encounter employees of these occupational licensees in the field, whether they're transporting bait, trapping bait, or in this case, out buying, selling fur. And so there's from a department standpoint, a need to know that those people are licensed, those employees are licensed, that they're working under somebody. So what we're asking you to do is to substantiate it, to put into rule that a licensee needs to list their employees and agents on the application who are going to purchase fur-bearing animals. And there was a question during the session yesterday, the public hearing, and the answer to that question, which has already been answered, but it only pertains to folks who are going to be out there purchasing fur, because that's what the statute that authorizes you to issue these licenses, it only requires the element of purchasing fur there. So somebody that's working, fleshing out fur, skinning fur, this has nothing to do with that. It's only those folks that are going to be out running routes, purchasing fur. For example, we have some non-resident fur dealers. As you can see, we don't have very many, but we have one that comes all the way from Illinois. And so they have four or five people that run the routes for them. So those would be the people that would have to have their name listed on the application. And then we would have an idea of who those people are, and we can verify that in the field that they're okay to be out running those routes there, and that they're working under somebody else, and that they don't need a license of their own in that case. The second part of this, as many of you recall a few months ago, is to put some safeguards in place too, we finalized it, like I said, for bait dealers to prohibit somebody that's been revoked or suspended from continuing to move on, whether it be to another fur dealer or somebody else. So what this also would do would prevent somebody, or allow the department to refuse to issue or amend a license to somebody that employs an individual that's had their privileges to buy fur revoked or suspended within that previous or current calendar year. Or has been denied the issuance of a license. So it's kind of identical. As we talked last month, we said we would look at other occupational licensees, and this one fits the bill because we've got those other folks, employees out in the field doing that. Some of the other licenses, such as captive game bird dealers or taxidermists, they're a lot of times confined to a location, whereas with fur dealers, they're out regardless all over the state. And so that's the rationale for bringing that forward. We have no changes from proposal, so I'd ask for you to approve this measure.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, any questions? Apparently not. Comments? All right, all in favor of the motion would say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right, Kathy, you want to vote on that, or you're fine? Aye, she's aye too. Okay, thank you. Okay, muzzle loaders.
So the last one I have to present to you today is a proposal to bring forward to essentially allow the use of a muzzle loading handgun for big game hunting. We've received some requests over the course of the last year to consider this opportunity, if you will, and in looking at a combination of what's in statute and what's currently in rule, although it's not 100% crystal clear, a good interpretation is that we've made some measures that prohibit that don't authorize the use of muzzle-loading handguns, And I think that's primarily because what we're dealing with is technology and evolving over time. So I bring it forward to you today to allow this to happen. What it would do would allow the use of muzzleloading handguns for big game and then put into place some of the requirements there for what type. So what we're looking at is that they would have to discharge a projectile that's 50 caliber or larger. For muzzleloading rifles right now, the statutory requirement is 44 caliber or larger. It would have been nice to mirror that, but if you recall last month when Dale Gates presented this to you, we had to look at a little bit of the ballistics there and lethality and the foot-pounds of energy, and the reason why we're asking you to go with 50 caliber or larger is so that it comports with some of the foot-pound of energy requirement that's in other rule that we have here. So we require 500 foot-pounds of energy, so we're thinking that pretty much all the ammunition that gets up to 50 caliber or larger is going to fall within that acceptable range there. And the other last issue item with this would be to remove the word factory from the rating on the ammunition there. Across the big game hunting, we have enthusiasts that like to load their own ammunition. If you look at it right now, it has to be factory rated. So by removing the word factory there, we just, what is already widely accepted, we all know people are loading this, so this is just a common sense cleanup item there as far as that goes. And I'd stand by for any questions.
Questions on muzzle loaders loading? Motion to approve. Okay, is there a second? Seconded by Kathy. Any other comments? Yes, go ahead, John.
Locke in here. Did this Sabot question get answered? There was a guy here yesterday that asked about Sabots.
Yes, did have a visit on that issue there, and I think what the question was sometimes the bullet can be smaller than that number there, but as an entire projectile coming out of there, it still comports with that size requirement there. So that was the gist of the conversation.
Okay, good. Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we approve this finalization. And any other comments? All in favor would say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? That's carried.
You're on a roll. You want one more?
Good morning again, Commission, and Secretary Hepler, Tony Life, Director of the Wildlife Division. I have Kevin Roebling here to help the conversation on the bull hunter education requirement. We're here to ask you to finalize the proposal that you made a month ago to remove the requirement of taking the bull hunter education prior to going bull hunting. I want to be really clear, what we're asking you to do here is not to get rid of bull hunter education. Bull hunter education plays an important role, as Mr. Kolbeck stated yesterday, in recruitment in certain situations. What we're asking you to do is to take action to remove the administrative rule that makes it a requirement for people to take prior to going to field. Give you a little background on this. This was back in the early 90s when this was implemented. Essentially, the commission then adopted this regulation under the agreement that the South Dakota Bull Hunter Organization, SDBI, would take the lead on training and putting on coursework out there. There have been a number of instances in the past 25 years when this regulation has been in place where concern was expressed about the limited opportunity to attend those classes, and this commission has given some consideration to this issue in the past, a number of years ago. The resolution at those times was that SDBI needed to step up their efforts and provide additional educational opportunities. So that sufficient opportunity was out there to meet the regulation and become a bull hunter. That worked for a while. However, in 2016, we received formal notice from SDBI that they no longer would retain the responsibility of putting on these courses, coordinating those things, and making sure there's a sufficient number out there. Since then, a number of the instructors have kept them going in certain areas, but we have many gaps in the state where you cannot take bull hunter education. And I'll share a map with you here as we wrap up the conversation. Important to point out that in South Dakota, when you are 16 years old, you can go hunting. You can pick up a shotgun, hunt pheasants. You can pick up a .30-06. You can go hunt deer without any formal training at all. Our hunt safe requirement ends at age, once an individual turns age 16. That's not the case for bow hunter education. In fact, the bow hunter education requirement is out there primarily to teach people how to hunt, bow hunt, not necessarily focused on safety, although there are safety elements that are also incorporated in the Hunt Safe program. So it helps bow hunters learn the sport and be able to do it right. There are situations, and I think Commissioner Olson's situations with his 8-year-old son that he talked about earlier, probably don't need that. I believe after many years of hunting that Commissioner Olson is capable of giving the proper training and guidance to help his 8-year-old son eventually become a bull hunter in South Dakota. There may be other situations where an individual does not have that mentor to help them learn the sport and be able to participate. In those situations, the bull hunter education course is essential. And I do concur with Mr. Colbeck's comments yesterday that in certain situations, it is a recruitment tool because it's the only way that people can learn how to bull hunt. But in many situations, it's not necessary and it shouldn't be required. In South Dakota, we have a mission within our strategic plan that's been talked about and referenced multiple times here this morning in a lot of things that we have going on in the state pertaining to hunting. We also had a presentation from Secretary Hepler yesterday that talked about the national conversation that's going on with recruitment and retention of hunters and how we have challenges ahead of us. So one of the things we have some control over is the impediments that keep people from becoming hunters. The requirement of bow hunter education is an impediment. So I think the question comes down to then, is it a necessary impediment? And I would challenge you to consider that in this situation, it is an impediment in certain situations. It is a value. In fact, if you look at where we have courses around the state, we did this analysis many years ago, we do have more bull hunters in those areas of the state where the bull hunter education course is offered more frequently. In particular, in Mitchell, there's a major outdoor recreation equipment retailer there, put on a number of classes. The number of bull hunters that we have in that area of the state is considerably higher than we do in many other areas of the state. Now, that could be because of the opportunity to learn about bull hunting and get involved, but also because the impediment isn't there to those that want to learn how to bull hunt or because the course is more available there. I have a map here. Kevin, you want to hand that out? That does show this. Now, to take the course, you can both take it online or in person. Online works for a lot of people. I'm not so sure it would. It certainly wouldn't work for everyone. But just as an example here, if Commissioner Locken decided, I want to take up bow hunting, and I have no idea whether you've ever bow hunted or not, but say you hadn't, and you decided after all this talk, hey, I'm going to be able to go bull hunting in September. I think I'm going to try that this year. you would either if have to figure out a way to take that course online, and if not, if you're not the type that would learn online very well, your only option living in a community of 26,000 people would be to travel to Watertown or to Mobridge or to Huron to take that course to learn how to bow hunt and become a member of the bow hunting community. And if it happened to be that weekend that when the course is going to be held in Watertown, your wife had other plans for you, obviously that conflicts, and if you're a wise man, you're not going to bow hunter education that day. But I'd also point down in the southeast corner of the state, the largest city we have in South Dakota, no courses available there in person. Here is where the challenge lies. When we put a regulatory burden upon the citizens of our state and then don't provide them a sufficient opportunity to comply with that regulation, is that right? And once again, there are important components to the bowhunter education program. Some of those can and are already incorporated into HuntSafe. And if there is a desire for people to learn more about bow hunting, I think there's an opportunity to have an additional hour, two, half day added to our Hunt Safe curriculum that would help these folks become bow hunters if that's what they desire. But ultimately, I think in its time, this education course had its place as a requirement, and it still has its place as an important recruitment tool to certain individuals. But I think the time has run its course on making people take this class before they are able to obtain a license in South Dakota. We are only one of 13 states that have a requirement like this. So there are 37 of the other 50 states that have no requirement of this nature on the books right now. And many of those are the western states where bow hunting is extremely popular. And I think all of you can attest, if you've ever been to the WAFA meetings, there are no issues with that in many of those western states where such a requirement is not in place. So once again, I want to reiterate that our goal here with you today is to not ask you to eliminate bow hunter education. What we're asking you to do is remove the requirement that people must take this bow hunter education course to become a bow hunter in South Dakota. With that, we'd ask for your adoption of the finalization. And Kevin, anything to add? If there's any questions, we should be happy to answer those questions for you.
Any questions for Tony? Marianne.
Commissioner Boyd here. I'll give this a try. Thank you for your explanation. That was incredibly helpful to me and likely swayed my decision on this particular issue. Just for clarification, these classes will still exist, and wherever we have information on the requirement, the current requirement, will there be information on accessing it online, other opportunities where they can get that training if they'd like it?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Boyd. We will continue to work with these instructors to post it online. To ensure that news releases go out about the opportunity to take these courses. We'll continue to make sure that we help develop more of these courses. In fact, we're already going to do that out west. We have a fantastic project going on with the community out there of additional shooting sports opportunities that Scott spoke to you about a little bit ago. We're already in conversation with another major archery retailer out there about additional education classes to help recruit more bow hunters into the bow hunting community, and it will continue to be an emphasis of ours with if this rule is repealed.
I would agree, Marianne. I was prepared to vote against this, and after such a compelling argument by Tony here, I think I agree, and it does bring it more in line with our rifle hunting regs. So, yes, John.
Commissioner Locken, there's a little bit of an attitude of let's relax the rules, let's let younger kids be shooting. We were out in Montana snowmobiling three years ago, and early in the day, my son said, look at that group over there. They don't know what they're doing. and it was a Minnesota group. And by the end of the day, we were digging a kid out of an avalanche. And he had the wrong mentor. And I read the obituary, and he was a single mother type situation, and the kid was with the wrong mentor. We still need these people educated going out there.
I agree, Commissioner Locke, and I believe that's really important that people receive the proper training, the proper opportunity, and I do agree that in some cases this course is exactly what they need. I'd also say there are other cases, and again, I'll point to Commissioner Olson's situation. I believe that he's going to be an excellent mentor to his son and teach him how to properly hunt with archery equipment in the course of bow hunting. But I couldn't agree more. I think people sometimes may not recognize the importance of ensuring that they're properly prepared to go afield, regardless of what that outdoor recreation is. There are many ways that I think that that can be accomplished.
But we're probably going toward more shooting ranges and some of that stuff, and we need these. We can't just turn these people loose that aren't trained.
Absolutely, and I believe that those that need the training are going to have more opportunities in South Dakota to receive that training. With the projects we have going on to increase those shooting sports. So those individuals that do need that training to be sufficient are going to find an opportunity to get it. Now, maybe they'll find it in the online course, and nowadays there are plenty of people that can do that. We're going to continue to work with we helped develop that curriculum with Calcame, a national electronics communications company, put together a great course, and we're going to continue to work with them to make sure that that is available to anyone who wants to learn about bow hunting and become a bow hunter in South Dakota.
Promoting education will continue on.
It definitely will, Mr. Chairman. And I don't want to sell that short. That's really important to us, and that's going to continue to happen, and we're going to continue to work with Mr. Twomley and Mr. Colbeck, who are here yesterday, who are obviously very passionate about this, to make sure that we help them provide those educational opportunities whenever and wherever we can.
Yes, go ahead.
I truly believe that you guys will work hard at it. I'm still just at this point not ready to say that it. I think sometimes you need a rule to go learn, and that the mother doesn't know that, and sometimes a parent. I know that Russ will be a good mentor to his student, to his child, but sometimes I think it's good to learn from others, and nothing against the department's thoughts and where you're going. I'm glad that you want to keep everything, keep the education going, but sometimes I think when you don't have to take it, it's too easy not to. Thank you.
Go ahead, Gary.
Could you talk a little bit about the Hunt Safe program and the training, and is archery part of that? I mean, who are the teachers there? Is there some way we can recruit teachers to come in and help educate bow hunters? I mean, it's kind of a bunch of questions.
Certainly. Commissioner Jensen, there's a lot of overlap between the instructors, the Hunt Safe instructors that we have, and those that also teach the bow hunter education class. There are components of the class already that address bow hunter safety, in particular tree stand safety. I believe there's a portion in the book right now, which is one of the elements of the current bow hunter education and curriculum that does address safety. We can, and I think that's what I mentioned. There'd be opportunities maybe for add-on courses or to take some of these bow hunter education instructors who are not also Hunt Safe instructors and ask them to be a bigger part of these educational opportunities that are much more frequent. I mean, we have those in every county. In fact, there's statutes that require those
to be held in every county, and there's multiple courses offered throughout the year. That is a great opportunity for us to bring some of those additional instructors in and publicize that additional opportunity that could come along with Hunt Safe of learning to be a bow hunter also.
You know, we ask everybody to do so much. Has the department or the local COs or local staffs, are there any options there that we could provide this education through our own staff? I'm not suggesting that other than to just ask.
Some of our staff are already involved. We do have certain members that take a strong interest in this topic. And the alternative is to take this on entirely upon ourselves and provide more of these classes. But that's going to have to come at the expense of some other activity. And so that's where, when it comes down to prioritization of our time, our staff time is extremely valuable. We've talked about that many times. And it would be a valuable endeavor for us to elevate our involvement in bow hunter education. But once again, with the focal point being to learn how to bow hunt, I think there are many other opportunities out there without placing that upon our staff, who some are qualified and some others, and some aren't. But I would much rather allow those parents or other mentors that are out there, grant them that ability or let them take care of that rather than having to make it a government provided program. In South Dakota, you know, we take a lot of pride in minimizing government intrusion into how we live our lives in this state. And I think this is a great example of where government isn't necessary to make sure that this one's done right.
Any other questions? All right, is there a motion on this one?
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we approve the finalization of bow hunter education. Any other comments? All in favor would say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Got one.
Boyd, aye. Locken?
Aye.
Barry Jensen?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Peterson?
No.
Barry Jensen?
Aye.
Five.
Five. Okay. Thank you.
All right, Kevin Roblin here, Special Projects Coordinator with Game Fish and Parks. If I could have you turn to page 22 of your booklets. Moving on to the requirements or the overall rule that's currently in place that states if an applicant who fails to submit an initial drawing application in a single season for a period of 5 consecutive years forfeits any preference points accrued for that season. So essentially, if there is inactivity in somebody's account regarding a specific season, let's say they do not apply for preference or they do not apply for that season, in 5 years they'll lose their accrued preference points. We would just purge them from their profiles. Now, the amendment to this rule would allow inactivity for 5 consecutive years or more. And those folks would not lose their accumulated preference points. So there has been no recommended changes from proposal. Really, what this does is it just gives folks that opportunity to retain the preference points they purchased. In 2015, they started purchasing those points. In some cases, they're $5. In other cases, they're $10 for elk and other big game species. And we feel as a department, if they purchase those points belong to those folks. And even if there is an activity for greater than 5 consecutive years, that those points would remain in their profiles. Any questions on that?
Is there an ending date?
There would be no ending date. We discussed this at the proposals, and really the reason being is if there were an ending date, it wouldn't really matter to our license database. We use our license database. We keep those profiles in there as the actual database where we can query and obtain the data that we're looking for. So let's say a profile that was created 20 years ago will still be in our licensing database 20 years from now. So if we were to just take out the preference points of within that profile, it would not free up any space or do anything pertaining to the overall profile itself. I mean, that profile itself will still remain in place because that's our actual database. That's where we get, all of the information you'll see on the licensing reports and all of the information you see on the age graphs and things like that. So that profile will still remain in place.
I see. Okay.
Any other questions?
Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Seconded that we approve this finalization. Any other questions? Seeing none, all in favor would say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? It's approved.
Okay, we handled action item number 23 there, or the finalization number 23 yesterday. So if we could move on to number 24. This is the hunting requirement, the mandatory CBD testing. If you turn your attention to page 24 in your booklets, what this does here is it really just adds deer to the language of a mandatory submission for CBD. You can see there the rule above, mandatory submission of samples for chronic wasting disease testing. Those include just elk currently. We'd like to add deer to the list of mandatory submissions, and the reason being is we really want to increase our overall sample to get us a good solid prevalence rate in Custer State Park. We want to make sure every animal that is harvested, any cervid, deer, or elk, is a mandatory submission to get us those data, to get us a better idea of what the prevalence rate is in CSP, and overall to help us make better management decisions regarding those cervid populations in Custer State Park. There is no recommended changes from proposal on this one as well. Any questions?
Move approval.
Second. Okay. What is submitted? What's the sample?
In this case, they would have to submit their head to, it'd be the head, actually, and we're looking for the brain obex or the nodes, and staff would then remove those nodes or the obex and get that CBD sample. We can do that very quickly, 5 to 10 minutes at times. If the hunter would like to wait around for us to pull that sample, that would be probably how we do it, especially on some of these trophy animals. It doesn't take very long. It is somewhat, if they're going to mount the animal, we obviously have to make sure we don't ruin the cape or anything like that, and we can do that. We have very trained personnel that are very good at pulling these samples out, and it will require some staff time to make sure they're available for these mandatory submissions, and to make sure it's not an overarching burden on our hunters that do harvest elk or deer in CSP. So we have had pretty good success with elk, and we just want to include deer.
Can any CO do that, or do they have to take it?
In some cases where the hunter would like to have their head back immediately, we'll have a biologist pull those samples. So in other cases, the CO will collect those heads, and then we'll pull those samples. If it was a doe, for example, we do have, I believe, 30 antlerless licenses in CSP for white-tailed deer and for muzzleloader season. And those, for example, would likely just be turned in, and we'd have biologists pull those samples within 2 or 3 days. With those trophy bucks and bulls, though, a lot of times they'll meet with the biologist, and then we'll get those samples pulled.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? All in favor of the motion would say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? It's carried. Thank you.
And I believe that wraps up finalizations.
Mm-hmm. Okay.